All right, we are back on the record with the title-setting board, and we have substituted Jason Gallander from the Office of Legislative Legal for Sharon Eubanks, and so the board is now includes Mr. Gallander. All right, the next item up is proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 57, voter registration. If the proponents could come forward and state your names. Oh, your turn. Do it again.
Scott Cadiz.
Jason Legg.
Thank you. All right, and if you want to just start out by telling us what you believe the single subject of your initiative is.
The single subject of this initiative is to create an automatic voter registration mechanism through driver's license facilities.
All right, any questions by the board?
I don't have any questions.
I don't either.
All right. Any discussion on the single subject?
I'm prepared to vote.
You? Okay. Yes. You want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find that proposed initiative 2015-16 number 57 concerning voter registration has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set title.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Right. Passes. And that takes us to the language of the question. The proponents have any statements on the staff draft?
We do. We have a few concerns and suggested revisions. Does the title board have a copy of the document we prepared with some of those concerns?
I do.
Yes.
It's in the packet, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Beginning there with line one, the use of the term opt-out to describe voter registration, we prefer that the terminology we've come accustomed to using and we think is more natural and in keeping with describing the intent and the mechanism, or excuse me, the intent and the operation of the initiative would be to use the term automatic. And more specifically, even if that isn't the term that's used, we think that the term opt-out is confusing.
Yeah, I mean, I was more inclined to just not even indicate opt-in or opt-out and just say voter registration, but...
That was my thought, too.
Yeah.
In the title clause.
Right.
Okay. Under the theory that we're just giving notice of the general subject and then we'll describe what's actually, how the law is being changed.
Yes, certainly we would say that's what it's doing, that you would have to opt out, but that to describe it up there is probably not necessary.
I guess I would say I actually sort of like the opt out right in the single subject, just a little more trouble. I don't feel strongly about it, and it sounds like not voted, so I am fine with just going straight with voter registration. I do think that proponent's suggestion of automatic right in this single subject, I think is a little bit on the misleading side because there are, of course, ways to opt out of it. And I think that that could be more for the trailer. So I think it just depends how much we want to put, you know, sort of all the notice of what's actually happening in the trailer or not.
I prefer just excising opt-out.
Okay.
I move that change on line one as reflected on the screen.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We also had an additional comment to clarify on line three. Beginning in line two, providing for automatic voter registration for persons who apply. We'd like the clarification added through the use of the terms qualified unregistered preceding persons. So it would read, providing for automatic voter registration for qualified unregistered persons. And that's just the language that's used in the initiative itself as well.
I don't My view is that that is not necessary, but I'm open to others' views on it.
I mean, I think that the unregistered is unnecessary because that's just sort of assumed, I think. If they're already registered, it's not going to happen. You know, the qualified, I think, can be down below. I do have a general question for the proponents and the board as well. Do we think we have quite a lot of detail in the staff draft, and do we feel like we want to have, you know, specifically, I think anything beyond starting with the word allowing on line 6 to the end, I would just ask the question of how much of that do we think, if any, do we think we need?
I had a similar concern. This is a fairly focused proposal. It's certainly shorter than some of the initiatives we see. And this is a fairly long title, given that I think the main thrust of this is pretty simple. You show up, you get your driver's license, and that registers you to vote unless you opt out. And so I agree with Mr. Galunder.
What about one way to four?
But maybe we proceed lines 1 through 6 and then get to 6 through 11 when we get there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Before we continue through 6, I guess we're still there, but it's, we're fine with that as well. We think that makes sense and would err on the side of brevity, we think, too. I think in one of the proposed versions, we actually stopped at line 4, and we consider either.
Yeah, I was looking at that, so.
So we're open to that. I think I also heard you to say that you're comfortable with the use of qualified prior to persons. On that first comment?
No, I was less, well, I'm actually going to propose first that we change persons to individuals just because in the Colorado revised statutes, persons can refer to things other than actual people like corporations and stuff, while individual doesn't. I know that doesn't track the language of the initiative, but it's something I would suggest.
In case corporations apply.
Just kidding.
I agree with that revision.
Qualified?
Oh, no, individuals as opposed to persons.
We agree with that as well.
Okay. Move to adopt the changes as reflected on line 3 on the screen.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Still thinking about it?
No. It's just thinking.
I think I am okay with the word automatic, but I just wanted to make sure everybody else was. That's not a word reflected in the proposed initiative. I think it is a common term that people understand, and it's useful here, but I just raised that in case there are any questions or concerns from the board.
Yeah, I actually just have some kind of more generalized language changes, I think, tighten things up a little bit. Do you mind if I just
get
those? Oh, please, yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
Cool. First, this adds some, just after license on line 2, I insert examination just to track the language of the initiative and be add a little bit of clarity. And then instead of getting to the providing for it, also in line 2, I think I'd substitute on requiring. And I would just say requiring registration and get rid of providing for an automatic, and I'm sorry, requiring automatic registration. I am okay with the automatic. Yeah, I don't think we need voter because we've said that in the main. Require automatic registration, I would say, of any individual who meets the registration qualifications and we'll start there. We may go back to the proponent's suggestion to qualify, but it's all I think for now. And then we had or. So it's then and strike out who apply you. Any individual who meets registration. Sorry.
I would say any individuals who meet the registration qualifications and who apply.
Right.
Or have applied.
Yep, that's what I had. Yeah, and actually I would make individuals singular and probably explain why.
Yeah, I think that's probably better.
Okay, so any individual who meets the registration qualifications and who has applied, and I'm sorry, who applies for or has applied then within the last 5 years. Then a four after applied. Oh no, I'm sorry. Not a, take out that four, sorry. Or has applied within the last 5 years, four, comma. Okay, and then stays the same. Then after card, on line five, take out the sem. Unless the individual declines to be registered. Send there. Then requiring the Secretary of State to send such strike persons to an individual. Notice of the. Just notice of the automatic registration. I'll keep that for now. So it's notice of the automatic registration. I'll just make this difficult. Oh, and the processes. By which the individual may decline to be registered or adopt a political party affiliation. Then period. And then that's
right. Okay. So I have, a general question. This first provision that says the Department of Revenue is going to give these records for the past 5 years, that's an ongoing obligation by the department to continue to generate records past 5 years?
No, thanks. I think that going forward in the future, anything that would have occurred in the past 5 years would have already, I don't know how to articulate this well, but we talked about this with the Colorado Legislative Council and at the earlier meeting as well. So that right now at the date of adoption, they'll have the duty to go back 5 years. In the future, in 5 years, the applicants that they'd have the reflective duty to go back to would have already been, had that information relayed as of the enactment date. Does that make sense? So
as I read it, it says when this becomes effective, DOR goes back 5 years. Then from the non, it's required to transmit records of anyone who applies ongoing. And then obviously that's subject to rulemaking.
Right.
That's how I understand it. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think the 5 years is central, so I definitely want to see that in there. I don't really like the unless the person opts out. Because that makes it sound like they can do it there when it gets issued. And we kind of explain it better later.
But it's out of order a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it sound like they're going to ask me and I can opt out when that's, in fact, not going to happen. When I get my driver's license, nobody's going to ask me whether I want to be registered.
They're going to ask you later.
Right, they're just going to do it.
Well, they won't do it until they've sent out the notice asking you.
They are going to ask.
They cannot do it until that notice has been mailed out.
I think if you delete the unless the individual declines, the next clause or phrase adequately explains the what we're calling the opt-out process.
Right. Because what this is going to do is people who don't opt out, who maybe don't live here anymore, and so they're not going to opt out, but they have driver's licenses that they've never bothered to cancel, are going to get registered. They're never going to opt out because they're not here. So I don't want to make it look like there's this process where you can opt out at the DMV.
I think that's fair. I understand that.
Yeah, you're fine with that.
I just think there's that comma after four applies for or has applied within the last year's four. I don't think that comma is grammatically correct. Unless you put a comma before and.
Right. It's either two or none, and right. None is probably better.
Okay.
I'm not sure if this goes to whether or not it's proper grammar or semantics, but as far as the natural way I would read or say that, or excuse me, write or say that, I would only use four once. Who applies or has applied within the last 5 years, four.
I think either is fine,
either is fine. For,
with me, but I defer to the initial suggester of the language.
I think it's fine. Fewer words, if it works, is better.
Okay.
He's got the.
Actually, I don't know that. I don't know that if we need that who either, even though it sort of parallels the earlier one.
Yeah.
I don't think we need that.
I agree.
Is this going to happen for 16-year-olds too, or no?
No.
Because they can pre-register at DMV. Well, I mean, under Colorado law, they can.
Well,
they
it has to be a quote eligible elector.
But they're eligible to.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, they're eligible to. Okay.
That's our position as well. We don't think they're eligible electors.
Okay. So they'll still be asked.
Who's 16-year-olds?
Right.
Well, it says, so there's no ask. It is an automatic process, as I understand it, of DOR.
Right. But under current law, they're asked. So they'll still be asked, and no one else will be asked.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So they'll still be asked.
Well, isn't there some provision in here, and I'm just not seeing it, that this doesn't supersede the other registration options that are available at a DMV facility?
Yeah, that's our understanding, is this exists in harmony with that.
So there would be, everyone would get asked, but also everyone's data would be transferred. So it would be perhaps duplicative, but both would still occur.
Well, only 16 and 17-year-olds would be asked. Nobody else would be asked. So DMV will have two processes. One, if you're 16 or 17-year-old, you will be asked. If you're 18 or above, we will just forward your name to the county clerk, right?
Maybe I just misunderstand the initiative, but I thought what would happen is that everybody who is a qualified elector, so presumably 18 and over who are citizens and residents, would get that information transmitted. But also, everybody would also be asked if they want to register. Is that not right? Or does this supersede the...
No, that's our understanding. There's parallel. I think you're saying the same thing. So, well, except that you... So it's
no,
not just,
you'll be asked if you want to opt out. If
oh,
you're 16
I see.
Or 17-year-old, you're asked, do you want to register to vote? If you are 18, nobody at DMV is going to ask you anything. You're just going to go get your driver's license, and then you're going to get a notice from the clerk saying, do you want to opt out or declare a party affiliation? And then you have to then affirmatively do something. Whereas the 16 and 17-year-old has to affirmatively opt in and say, yes, I want to register. Other people, it's the reverse.
And the 16 and 17-year-old now is in a different statute somewhere that's not affected by this. Is that correct?
Well,
I'm not familiar with that. Because this, this is a repeal and reenact. So I read it as replacing the existing process with this process, not having sort of both the option to apply while you're there and the automated. As I understand it, no one's going to be filling out applications at the DMV anymore. You're going to walk in, they're going to automatically register you and then send you notice, and you can opt out of being automatically registered if you so choose.
We would like to add to that that we feel like we leave room for that to be done through rulemaking if necessary to maintain compliance with the National Voter Registration Act. So we're not precluding it, the possibility with this.
I'm trying to remember where
required
they put...
Required as a matter of the NVRA that
put,
you allow...
pre-registration in a different statute? Oh, it's not in 213 or... Oh, it's in the definitions, basically. So it's in the qualifications for registration. I don't think that makes him an eligible elector, but yeah.
So I guess I still don't understand the concern. So your concern is that this is not adequately reflecting the fact that some will be asked and others will not.
I mean, I guess as long as you say qualified elector, but it's not someone who meets the registration qualifications because 16 and 17-year-olds meet the registration qualifications.
But they're not qualified electors.
But they're not qualified electors. So
then what we want to say is any qualified elector instead of any individual who meets the registration qualification, which is also fewer words. And if that's the proponent's intent, is that how you expect this to work? That if you're not 18, you are not being automatically registered?
That's correct.
Okay. Then that's more accurate as well.
Yeah.
So this is where you don't want non-election experts like myself.
Or where I get too far into the weeds.
Yeah. No, I think that's a positive change that reflects the language of the proposal. I am satisfied with the changes up to the point where we delete the six lines of text, and I just would like a second to read those and make sure I'm okay excising them. I'm okay with deleting all that language because I think it's not central to the proposal. And it's not as brief as it could be with it included.
And I agree with that assessment.
Can I just ask, though, is it merely a election logistics issue about this 21-day prohibition?
Yeah. Well, I think so. I don't know.
As far as the intent, the reason we're including yeah. the prohibition?
Yes.
To respect an individual's liberty interest in not registering if they're so inclined.
I see.
That's one reason why.
Okay.
And if you're asking about the delay as to registering them, and that's ramifications where you're in that window where it runs into an election, we also don't want to have someone registered for an election without at least having that window to decline being registered.
Yeah, and I think the question, maybe not to speak for him, what Mr. Yarger is getting to is, but the 21 days you just picked, it seemed like a reasonable length of time for that, right? It's not like tied to some federal requirement or anything like that.
That's correct. It's also what's used in some other motor voter bills from across the country as well.
Okay.
For what that's worth. But it seems like a reasonable amount of time, and other examples indicate other people have felt the same way.
Could you remove the bubble, Stephen? Thanks. I suppose maybe I would just say semicolon after the last party affiliation. And add language something like and granting 21 days to decline to be registered or something like that, if we think that's even necessary to include. I don't know that it is or not. It talks about, as stated, it talks about the opportunity or processes, being informed of the processes by which an individual may decline to be registered, but it doesn't talk about the fact that they can do that. I mean, I think it's implied there.
Do you want to say something like the processes by which and period within which?
That's fine, instead of adding a new clause.
Yeah, within which the individual may decline?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Where are you guys at?
Where it says
by which on line 6.
Yeah. The process
you're not Stephen.
By which and time period within which. I don't think you can do by with a period.
Well, couldn't you just do process within which you can decline or whatever?
It depends. I mean, I think the concern was expressing to some point that there's a specific time period. Is that the reason for adding? I mean, I don't think it's strictly necessary. I do think it's helpful enough, and we can do it in few enough words that it's beneficial. I don't believe it's necessary.
I think either way is a legal title. I don't think it is problematic to exclude it. Let me just read it. Requiring the Secretary of State to send. Maybe it's unnecessary detail because the notion of processes encompasses a time period. You don't want to overcomplicate the title.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Fine by me.
Okay.
Do you want to accept the changes and let's...
And then I'll, after we accept those, I think I might have one more okay. minor comment.
Need a motion for that? Move to accept the changes as they currently appear?
Sure.
Second.
All right. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Accepting all the changes?
Yes.
Yeah, all changes reflected on the screen. So my only final comment is, and maybe it's fine, such an individual, I suppose, refers to qualified elector.
Yeah, now I think, right, now we, since we've gotten rid of individual, I think we just use elector instead.
Why don't we have an and in line three?
Yeah, typo.
Oh, okay.
It should be a who.
Does the board feel it's necessary to use elector as opposed to individual there?
We do, as I understand it, because individual would imply automatic registration of those who may be ineligible to vote. Does that make sense? We're concerned that those who apply at a DMV for a license might be beneath the age of the, you know, required voting age. And you use the term qualified elector in the proposal. So I think it's more accurate. And I presume also a non-citizen who obtains a driver's license would not be a qualified elector entitled to automatic registration.
Correct.
Right. I move the change on line three.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So first in line four, unless we're going to add something else, I think we just have the and there, because we don't have really even have a series anymore, right? So it's, we'll probably get rid of the semicolon, just do an and.
Oh, I see.
After card.
Mm-hmm. Then we're just, I think all we're doing is on lines five and six, replacing individual with elector.
I think either is fine, but.
Yeah, I'm fine with either. We've already narrowed the pool at that point.
Well, but since we've referred to it as elector and we're referring back to it with the way it's currently structured, it seems to me clearer to use the same term.
Okay.
That's fine. I don't have any objection to that.
Okay.
For my edification, an elector
yes.
is someone is anyone
who
may vote but does not vote, and once you are an elector that has voted, you've become a voter. Is that true as a matter of terminology?
No.
It's always elector.
I thought elector come with the loaded meaning that you're qualified to vote. So saying a qualified elector is almost that you can't be an elector if you're not qualified to vote. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that might be, although you do use that. Oh,
I think
you use eligible.
Yeah.
So I think we ought to make that change. As opposed to qualified, use eligible. Thank you for that.
That eligible does mean that someone meets the qualifications.
Yes, that's okay. Different than being eligible to register.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's accurate to call someone an eligible elector who is not yet registered to vote?
No. Yeah. I don't know. This is...
Well...
Someone who meets the qualifications, I guess.
It is the terminology used here, and I'm comfortable with it because of that.
An eligible elector means a person who meets the specific requirements for voting at a specific election.
Including registration?
Well, if that's a requirement for voting, then
right.
Yes. But if no specific provisions are given, an eligible elector shall be a registered elector, as defined in subsection 35.
Ah.
So it seems like they're talking about registered electors. But a registered elector is someone who's complied with the registration provisions of the code and is eligible to vote.
Okay, I think the term we want is probably just from 12, just elector. Elector means a person who is legally qualified to vote in this state. And that's all we're talking about, right? Someone's legally qualified. So that covers the 18, and it covers being a citizen and, I guess, not having any other disqualifying factor, like being in prison or something.
Right.
So it seems to me we just want it, we don't want to say eligible, that elector is actually good enough since it does say legally qualified.
Yeah.
Is that the intent?
We want the message to be relayed that people that are going to be automatically registered are eligible to vote. They're electors. But we're worried that the use of a term of art like elector without additional descriptors is will not be recognized for what it is by a layperson. So elector comes with the baggage that you're qualified, you're eligible to vote.
Then,
but will the average reader know that?
Okay, then why don't I suggest this, using the statutory definition, require automatic registration of any individual who is legally qualified to vote in this state. That just tracks the statute.
That's all.
For a definition of elector exactly and gets the message across. Or I guess we could say in Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you can go back to individual.
Right.
And the wheel goes round.
Okay, now I think we're in business.
I think we made that harder than we had to.
Move that change, and then we'll...
Sure. Move that we adopt the changes as currently shown.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right.
Unless there's anything else, I think I'm ready to move the...
Let me read
title,
it.
But...
A change to the Colorado revised statutes concerning voter registration through driver's license examination facilities and in connection therewith requiring automatic registration of any individual who is legally qualified to vote in Colorado and who applies or has applied within the last 5 years for the issuance, renewal, or correction of a driver's license or state-issued identification card and requiring the Secretary of State to send an individual notice of the automatic registration and the processes by which the individual may decline to be registered or adopt a party affiliation.
I move to adopt that title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All right. That takes us to, I think you all are next also, proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 58. Let's do single subject first, and then let's talk about fiscal note, and then we'll get into the question. Can you start by introducing yourselves and then tell us what you believe the single subject of this initiative is?
Scott Cadiz.
Jason Legg.
We believe the single subject of this initiative is the creation of a refundable income tax credit to voters who cast a ballot in a general year election.
Any questions on the single subject?
I actually do have one. It's not exactly on the single subject. It's a clarification point, which is you use language in terms of how the credit is calculated that says the amount of the credit is the amount of revenue generated by the new tax divided by the eligible. No, sorry, I'll find it. I believe it's in subsection 5. So it basically says however much money the tax brings in, the individual credit is that less administrative cost, and then divided by the eligible number of voters in the general election year. What I just want to qualify clarify is when we're talking about the eligible number of voters, are we talking about the people who actually voted, or are we talking about the people who could have voted? You know, everyone who's registered, or just the people who actually voted?
The people who could vote.
The people who could vote.
Correct.
Okay. Then if that's the case, I have a bit of a concern about the single subject, and the concern is this. You're calculating, I know this is intended to increase voter participation, but you're calculating a credit based on dividing a pool of money by the number of people who could have voted. So let's suppose that that's, I believe the total registered in Colorado is in the ballpark of three million, just for hypothetical purposes. And let's say two-thirds of them actually vote. So you're calculating a credit amount that's all the money you bring in from the tax divided by 3 million. But you're only going to give out credits to maximum the people who actually voted, which is 2 million, which means that you're going to have a lot of money left over. And if you do it that way, all that money that's left over, based on terms of the initiative, goes to the general fund and is Tabor exempt money. I have a concern that, based on some case law precedent going the other way, that that's a second subject, because what you're doing is allowing a significant increase in Tabor exempt, no less, general fund spending that the voters voting for this would not necessarily anticipate.
In what way do you envision that as being unanticipated?
Well, there's some case law out there that talks about if you do a tax question.
I view it as being unanticipated, and the way this reads, it suggests, I mean, you know, your single subject, right, is, you said, a refundable tax credit, and we can talk about whether that's the best description of it or not a little bit later. But a voter, what's not supposed to happen is a voter shouldn't be surprised by something. I think a voter would be surprised looking at this initiative. We have a fiscal estimate of $220 million in taxes. Let's say we have 70% voter participation, so you have roughly 30% of the money left over. That's, let's just ballpark it, $60 million. That's $60 million of new general fund money that the state can spend for whatever, any purpose that it wants. That's legal under the general fund. You know, and I don't think someone voting for refundable tax credit for what seems to be a narrow purpose would expect that the state would also be able to just spend $60 million of new money. So that's the concern. And the case law, we have precedent from a series of Tabor cases where initiatives made a bunch of local tax cuts and then required the state to reimburse local governments for the tax revenue lost. And anyways, what the Supreme Court said was that the voters wouldn't expect that by enacting these local tax cuts, you'd be forcing cuts in state services. And I think this is kind of the flip side of that coin. And I'm concerned that because of that, it's a second subject.
In those cases, did the law creating that circumstance also forecast out that there would be whatever is not claimed would go to the general fund, or the opposite of that in that instant case? Because the reason I'm saying we think it's foreseeable is that this says anything unclaimed. And there would be something unclaimed even if we used everyone who could vote or everyone who right. did vote if they didn't claim the credit.
Right. That's my concern. I agree that there is this case law out there and it's potentially problematic. I'm struggling with whether or not it is directly applicable here, given that in no way of administering this tax increase could you guarantee there would not be excess revenue.
No, that's right. But I think...
But I understand you to say that this almost builds into it a guaranteed increase in general fund revenue.
Well, it's a question of the magnitude of the increase. I think if you're doing the math up front by the number of people who actually voted, then what that says to me is our intention is to take in all this money from the tax and give it all back in the form of refundable credit. We know we won't quite get all of it given back because some people who could claim the credit won't claim it. But, you know, that's sort of more of a somewhat unavoidable consequence, and it's relatively less money than going to the general fund. We had, for example, the last off-year election, about a 54% voter participation rate. So even if this, because people want to claim the credit, improves that, and let's say it's even two-thirds, we're not talking about sort of an incidental effect of some money going to the general fund. We're talking about what looks to me like a second purpose, which is to put a lot of money in the general fund. And that's why I think I'm a lot less comfortable with this if you're calculating the credit based on eligible electors versus the people who actually voted.
Where would your concern be satisfied if, rather than dividing, having the denominator, oh boy, this is going to get scary.
Yeah, if the denominator...
Be the number of those who voted as opposed to those eligible.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, and I interrupted you. Please go ahead.
I was going to ask, thinking about this relative to other initiatives in precedent, any time where a tax increase is put forward and that tax revenue is used for multiple purpose, is that per se violative of the single subject rule? Say with marijuana tax increases, and that's got myriad purposes, which is my understanding that it would have. I think I can think of other examples too. Would that be violative as well?
Well, I mean, it depends on what your multiple purposes are. If they're all related to a single subject, I mean, we've seen them on education and other issues. I think the problem here is that this is not something that someone voting on this would anticipate, that you are taking... I mean, on its face, most voters would think this is a tax credit for people that vote, and the tax collected is going to be related to that. I think it would be surprising to most people to learn that you're going to have this big surplus built in. And it's not just going to be based on the people who didn't mark it on their income tax. It's going to be...
Right.
And it's going to be Tabor exempt. And so it's going to raise the, you know, the Tabor ceiling, and it's going to have all these other effects.
And if I could just clarify, based on the marijuana hypothetical, the purpose of those amendments was to raise revenue. And then you use that revenue on various things. Here, the purpose, as you've laid it out, is not to raise revenue. It is to encourage voting. But then there is this... Perhaps it's not a purpose, but it's another aspect of this, which is necessarily to raise a very significant amount of revenue and put it into the general fund. That's the concern I think we have.
Yes.
It sounds like part of the heart of that concern is based on assumptions as far as what goes to the general fund and what doesn't. And I'm curious if we were to say we assume it will get 100% voter turnout, if that changes the discussion, or if that's based on... what we got from the state economists, because they do, or
that
how
was
we
my
do
next
handle that step.
Line of inquiry for the board is,
well, first, I think
it is a matter of common knowledge and fact that it is extremely unlikely that we achieve that. That said, it is...
We're not supposed to look at effects,
right,
per se.
Right, but there... And that would all be fine if the... Well, I mean, maybe the title should be to raise revenue. And then here's what we're going to do with it. I mean, that's kind of the flip side of what we're talking about. And I don't think you want that to be your title. You know, that the intent of your initiative, single subject, is to raise revenue. And then we're going to do these things with the revenue that you raise. I suppose we could write it that way.
I think that's where I was going, is that... the intent is to impose a new tax on income over a certain amount. And then you can specify what you do with that amount, that revenue.
I'm curious, what do you guys think about that expression of the intent? I mean, I would characterize the intent from what I've seen as the intent is to increase popular voter participation for the purpose of sort of giving the common person more influence in our public policy than they currently have now or in our system. I think, I mean, I understand what's being said, but it seems to me that the tax is more a mechanism for achieving a purpose than your purpose. Is that fair?
Well, I thought of answering that question as kind of saying the same thing in reverse, but I think it can be viewed or stated both ways. And if it's objectively determined, the single subject determination is objective, I think that that's an avenue to explore, that the primary purpose is raising revenue, and then these are what we do with it. I stated that in the inverse because I thought, you know, I didn't think about your point that a large portion of this revenue has a second purpose, because I'm hoping it's a nominal, a tertiary purpose. That'll kind of be built out. But based on that assumption that I came into this with, I think I was saying the same thing as far as what we view the single purpose as, creating revenue for this tax credit or creating this tax credit funded by this revenue.
Well, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can submit a new proposal and go through this process again and change it to alter the title. But right now we're voting on the single subject of this, and then we have to craft a title. I believe there is a single subject, and we can craft a title for it, and we can move on to that. But, you know, based on the way this is written and the way it operates, you might, maybe you do or you don't, believe that it reflects the intent or purpose of what you personally subjectively have in mind, and that's something you have to decide on your own.
So you think we have a single subject even with the potentially large diversion of money to the general fund?
I think we do, because if this single subject is to impose a new tax, then we can set a title for it.
Okay.
Yeah, I just don't know, because that prior case law, I mean, it was to set it was to increase a tax.
Yeah,
but it wasn't to increase a tax and thereby create secondary consequences of that tax by virtue of what the state had to do. Right. Here, there's a state tax that will be levied. Now, there are ways that that state tax must be spent, but the subject is a new tax. That's the way I see it. This is a technical and sometimes difficult area of law, but that's the way I understand the case law as it is now, understanding that that's my view and others might disagree.
Well, then maybe we should – it's a little bit tricky. So I guess then the vote would – we'd move to find a single subject, and then the presumption would be we're going to draft a title based on – the tax increase as opposed to the subject of the tax increase, then connection there with the credit and leaving the purpose to the trailer.
Right. Yes.
Because, you know, as I was viewing...
That I think is the challenge, is that in section one of the proposal, you've got this aspirational statement of purpose.
Right.
And what I'm saying is that is a fine aspirational statement, but as a objective matter, in order to set a title, we have to say that the subject is a tax increase. And then you have to specify how that tax increase will be used. I'm just thinking of other proposals to be out there to raise taxes and do things with that tax. I think it is appropriate under a case law to have a proponent request a 15% tax increase and do more than one thing with it. What you can't do is claim you're raising taxes, but what you're really doing is raising taxes and doing other things, if that makes sense. Or really lowering taxes and then increasing other sources of revenue that have to go elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I think I worked that out in my mind.
Okay.
Want to make a motion?
I move that the proposal contains a single subject and we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No. And I am going to very briefly explain. This sort of goes back to
64, too, where I was the dissenting vote, where we set a title on that, and I felt that it was log rolling to impose a tax on a product that could only be consumed by people 21 and over, and then use it to specifically for the purpose of school funding for people who can't use the product at all. And I recognize that that's a controversial position, one that the court might or might not uphold. It was a pretty close call for me then. And I guess it is now. You know, I do feel that as written, the amount of money that seems likely to flow to the general fund from this Tabor exempt general fund money, no less, is sufficiently, as they call it, coiled in the folds of the initiative that a reasonable voter wouldn't expect to see it there. And for that reason, I believe we have two subjects.
All right. We're going to move to title setting. Do you have any comments on the staff draft? Well, let me start with the fiscal note. You have any comment on the fiscal note?
We did, and as was mentioned earlier, this is a technical area of law. But as to the increase in fiscal year spending, we looked to Tabor to see the definition of that. It's kind of the source, we feel like, for this estimate. And we believe that an increase in fiscal year spending excludes reserves and refunds. And so we're curious how that was given consideration in the drafting of the fiscal year spending estimate.
Well, is it a spending or is it a income? Where's my...
And I think that part of the difficulty is that what Tabor requires is that the estimate be of the first full fiscal year of impact. And the difficulty you have is that your credit, the first fiscal year of impact for the credit is 17-18. I'm not sorry, for the credit, for the tax increase is 17-18 when you bring it in, but there are no credits given out in 17-18. The credits are given out in 18-19, so they don't count against the 17-18 number.
That's correct, and we're trying to get our heads around the full meaning of the language in Tabor. But first, starting with this, we think this is, if our understanding is correct, an estimate in the increase in fiscal year spending. So as you said, the increase, it starts in 2017-2018. The refund starts in 2018-2019. I just call it 2017-2018 if that's easier. But in Tabor, in 2E, fiscal year spending is defined as all district expenditures and reserves increases except those for refunds made in the current or next fiscal year. So for 2017, we would view that tax increase as going towards a refund for the next fiscal year.
Yeah, I think if you're going to treat it that way, then what you have to say, the problem is you've said, I believe, that the income is tax exempt. When the tax comes in, it's exempt from Tabor fiscal year spending. Let's see. So you have in subsection 3, all revenues received by the tax shall be excluded from fiscal year spending. So if they're excluded from fiscal year spending, they're not contributing to the state's refund liability. So, you know, giving it back isn't a refund because they're just, it's just money that's not subject to Tabor at all.
Right. I think we're saying consistent things too. So going forward, we don't think it should be viewed as subject to Tabor or considered. The intent of Tabor is to advise taxpayers of increases in taxes, and that would not be one because it'd be coming back through the form of a credit for the most part. And at the outset, we're saying that the same thing should be considered by the current language of Tabor, that increases in fiscal year spending do not include refunds. And that's consistent with the public policy purpose of Tabor to advise people of when total government spending and their taxes go up. But here, it's a wash, aside from the administrative cost, which is, we think, a legitimate component of the fiscal year estimate.
Right. And however much money goes to the general fund.
Correct, which is not included in this estimate, I'd add, otherwise,
right,
as well.
Well, Well, I mean, I'm inclined to go with the state economist number.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what the voters want to know is, you know, how much money does the so, like, if you look at the total impact, you know, when it shows it 2 years out, it ends up netting that out because you're giving in odd years, you know, what you've got this is sort of funky variable thing where in odd numbered years, you're going to bring in a bunch of money, and in even numbered years, you're going to bring in a bunch and also refund a bunch. And I think that this note accurately reflects that. I mean, I think the voters, that Tabor notice provision is let's show the voters how much money the new tax is going to raise, and that's what this estimate says. And I think we should stick with it.
I agree.
All right. Then it would be shall taxes, state taxes shall be increased by?
Increase $220 million annually.
Annually. I'd just take out the rest of it and say any connection therewith.
Right, I agree. I think that's what we have to do. Unless you want in the statement of single subject, the clause, shall state taxes shall be increased $220 million annually on incomes above $405,000 or something like that. I don't think that's necessary, but.
So you would have the single subject as simply the statement of a tax increase?
I think you could do that, or if you think.
You could say by imposing an additional tax on the.
On incomes above $405,000.
We truly don't want any indication of the purpose at all before the comma.
Well, as you said, which purpose?
Yeah, I mean,
increasing general revenue dollars, or increasing or tax credits for those who vote.
Well, that's the rub, isn't it? All these multiple purposes. I mean, I had one as, and maybe some of the non-single subject guys should just shut up. But I had one say, you know, thrown out there concerning a financial incentive to increase electoral participation.
Yeah, I don't.
Well, that runs into what we just, I think.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I
my
think
understanding
that is,
of why we proceeded to set a title. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think that is surreptitious.
Okay.
I don't mind putting that up there.
What's that? Yeah, exactly. By imposing an additional tax. I just don't know if that's something that the title board agrees is necessary in the title clause or not. I go either way.
One other thing I want to mention, and I should have done this earlier and forgot to. Do we have a concern? This is a statutory measure. Tabor has a provision in subsection 8 that requires essentially flat income tax. I will quickly find it and read it, which says, any income tax law change, and this is a law change since it's statutory, after July 1st, 1992, shall also require all taxable net income to be taxed at one rate, excluding refund tax credits or voter-approved tax credits with no tax or surcharge. Now, I know it seems we have a refundable tax credit and a voter-approved tax credit in this measure, but the tax increase itself, you know, what that allows for is sort of uniform credits to be approved by the people or to be enacted. This take certain income, and I, in two ways. First, if it's over 405,000, it's taxed at a higher rate than other income. And secondly, it's only if it's for individuals, estates, or trusts. So if it's that rather than corporate income, it's taxed at a different rate than corporate income. We don't, on title board, constitutionality is not our concern. And, but I do want to ask the proponents, I mean, are you trying by statute, were you aware of that provision? Are you trying to, do you think this measure overrides it somehow?
We're aware of that provision, and just as the other provision we brought up, we believe that the excluding refund tax credits or voter proof tax credits is applicable in this situation. And to give that language in this provision of TABOR meaning, we can't think of another way you would apply it. This paragraph refers to increases in tax rates, and if a tax credit is not an increase in a tax rate, then there's no reason for that to be provided there. We can't think of a way to read that with so that it has meaning, if not applying in this situation. We just elaborate on that. We feel the same way about the earlier definition of fiscal year spending, excluding reserves and refunds for this in the next year.
Okay. I just wanted to raise that issue to the board and, you know, for consideration as to whether it's anything that needs to be mentioned in the title or not.
Well, I don't think they can override TABOR, so I think they're just going to
take
their chances.
I mean, I don't think we can point it out. I think the state economist is going to disagree, but as we saw from the fiscal note, but I don't.
Well, is your question that whether or not we need to include this within the title as a?
Yeah, I just wanted to raise the issue. And I mean, it's not, like I said, it's not the title board's place to really consider constitutionality or, I suppose, you know, notify the people of it either. But
right.
There is a provision of TABOR here that's. Anyways, I just wanted to.
I understand your concern. I don't think that. I think we have to be a bit careful about how wide a net we cast on trying to analyze how particular proposals affect existing law. I mean, we need to do a reasonable understanding, but in my view, the proposal doesn't mention it. Our job isn't to assess the proposal's compliance with other provisions of law, and so I think we should just leave that to other able bodies in state government to figure out.
Or litigants in court.
That's part of government.
I mean, I think if they were making a change in the Constitution somehow, then maybe we would mention that it's going to override a portion of TABOR. But since we know they can't override TABOR by statute, I don't know that it's going to change anything in TABOR.
Okay, well, I think what's still pending is whether or not we need to include within the title clause the mention of where this tax is. I mean, that it's on taxable incomes above a certain amount, or whether that's better left for the remainder of the title.
I mean, I like it up there, except I don't like the part where we adjust annually for inflation. I don't really think that's very central to the measure.
That's fine.
If you're going to take that out, would you want to just be more general with the number for accuracy and just say above a specified amount or something like that?
Well, we kind of dealt with this in our what is a food store discussion earlier today, and we decided that it doesn't really doesn't simplify or reduce language by including the number, so I suppose.
Include the number.
I think the number needs to be included somewhere in here, and so the fact that we'll include it in the title is...
Yeah, I'm fine with the number, Steve.
The only question is accuracy here. It's... an additional tax of 1.5% on the Colorado taxable income on Colorado taxable income that exceeds $405,000. That's not all Colorado taxable income.
Yeah, it's only individual.
It's only right. It's not corporate income.
Well, we just leave that
or partnerships or things like that. I suppose.
Yeah, just that. Yeah, perfect.
And I would take out of each Colorado taxpayer that is, and just say of each individual estate or trust, because it talks about Colorado taxable income. By definition, taxable income can only come from a Colorado taxpayer. So I would delete Colorado taxpayer that is. So I move the changes as currently reflected on the screen.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
You need iPads or something. It's hard for me to see up there.
I know. The glare.
Now it's the angle for me.
Oh. We'll get you an iPad. No, we won't. Can you...
Oh, can you just, well, there we go. Is that okay with Jason now?
Yeah.
Ask and ye shall receive.
You got to make sure I can do what I need to do.
Yeah.
So after the therewith, can we just shorten that whole Tabor thing and just say excluding revenue or exempting the additional tax revenue from the limitation on state fiscal year spending or something like that.
Yeah.
Or excluding the revenue from state fiscal year spending.
Excluding the new revenue.
State fiscal year spending limitations or?
Or maybe just from state fiscal year spending. It depends on that.
Okay.
I think you need limitations.
Okay. So then from those state fiscal year spending limitation.
What limitation in singular?
Nah, just limitation. Yeah, get rid of the S.
Singular.
Yeah.
I move that change.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. So I'm okay with what's left. I think we need to include the notion that excess revenue goes to the general fund.
Yeah.
Could we just trim a little bit?
Yeah, can we get rid of refundable and just say fund A and income tax credit?
And I don't think we need all this appropriated by the general assembly.
Yeah.
Right,
I
right.
Think we just say using the revenue to fund
yeah.
an income tax credit.
Yeah.
So go all the way
yeah,
back.
We think the term refundable is an important inclusion.
I was going to get there, yeah. But let's start with what?
Using the...
Using the new revenue.
We said new revenue before. And then get rid of down to through basis. To fund a refundable income tax credit for, and I wouldn't say made available to, I would just say
yep.
for. Any elector who not just votes.
Yep.
Just shorten things up.
Do we have to say for the income tax year in which?
No.
I think so.
I don't know if you need to specify the manner in which the amount of the tax credit is determined. I mean, of course you've got to do that. And this doesn't add any specificity. I think if you include the description of excess revenue, that's fine.
Yeah, and I don't think the rule make, I mean, they have to do it. I don't think people care about the rulemakings being done. They might want to see the rules. But.
Really?
I guess the question is the confidentiality issue. I mean, that's
a good point.
That is, and somebody here will correct me if I'm wrong, that's just true as a matter of existing law. So does it need to be called out? Even if that were included, wouldn't the Secretary of State be required to keep these voter records confidential? And the county clerks.
You mean the content of the ballot?
It's actually revenue. What you're implying is the Secretary of State is authorized or maybe required to share voting it because it's eligible for the credit. So they're saying the information or revenue, not the other way around.
Right. Yeah. Sorry if I wasn't clear.
Has to keep everything confidential, essentially, at least if it's in connection with tax returns.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
I don't really think we need it.
I guess we could ask the proponents, do you feel in terms of that it's important to have something about protecting confidentiality in the title?
No, we don't think that's crucial.
Okay. So... we need another clause to reflect the general fund provisions, but before we go on to that, the refundable term, that is sort of a technical term of art that means even if you haven't paid taxes, you get the credit. I guess I have two questions. One, is that central? Two, is refundable the best way to describe it? It is used, that term is used in the proposal, but it is sort of a technical term.
I think you'd need a lot more words to describe it if you didn't use that term.
So you're okay with it? You're the one who suggested taking it out. I just wanted to make sure. Oh, or yeah. Suzanne.
Yeah, that's fine.
Leaving it in?
Yeah.
Okay. Does somebody want to move what we've done so far?
Or a move that we adopt the changes that have been made thus far.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. And directing any excess funds, excess revenue. Directing any revenue in excess of the amount of the tax credit. In excess of, the amount. Well, we can work on this later. Let's get something up and then to the general fund.
We would just like to offer that we think the use of the word unclaimed would be helpful.
Well, you could say in directing any unclaimed revenue to the general fund. Now, this gets back into, if we think that fairly reflects the proposal, given that what the board has suggested is that the problem isn't necessarily unclaimed revenue. It is almost the guarantee of revenue of substantial amount that will be directed to the general fund.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if this thing says in subsection 5, you know, that it's calculated based on the people who actually voted, then to me, whatever goes to the general fund is incidental, and it's a function of two things: the administration costs, which are allowed to keep, and that's explicit in the initiative, and the fact that some people who could claim the credit won't. If instead, though, and the proponents have said that this is the case, the situation is that the credit amount is each individual credit is a smaller amount because we're using as the number to be divided by the larger number of eligible electors, not just those who are eligible to actually claim the credit, then we have essentially a design feature of this that doesn't have to do with claiming and sends money to the general fund.
What I suggest is just instead of unclaimed, use excess.
Well, see, I think the problem, though, is that people are going to vote for this and they're going to think, okay, there's $405 million, $220 million. So if 100 million people vote in this election, I expect to get X dollars back. And that's not what's happening. I mean, for our purposes, there's $220 million. If a million people vote in this election, I expect I'm going to get my 22. Is that what it would work out to? And that's not true. I'm going to get my $220 back. And that's not going to happen.
Right, and that's why I think, so it says using the new revenue to fund a refundable income tax credit. And the next clause would say, and directing any excess revenue to the general fund. Now, that previous clause that I just read doesn't indicate how much that refundable income tax credit will be or how it's calculated.
Right. And I think you have to put in the calculation or people are going to be deceived about their incentive to vote.
Okay.
I think there's two things. It's a question of what has to be in a title versus, I mean, this will get put out in the, you know, if this gets on the ballot in the blue book, there'll be discussion of what the credit amount would be and what the effect is. I mean, it's not going to get unnotified. So the question is do we have a way of indicating, you know, in a relatively brief and clear manner in a title what's likely to happen, which is that your credit isn't 220 million divided by the 2 million people who voted. It's 220 million divided by the 3 million people who could have voted.
Well, what I suggest we do is if you're comfortable with excess instead of unclaimed, maybe we accept that change and then we see if we can't make a change to the previous clause, and if not.
That's fine.
So I move the changes reflected on the screen on line 5.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Now, one way we could do this is add a clause saying, providing that the, and this is just, let's just put it up, Stephen, so that we can have something to discuss. Providing that the credit will be calculated. No, this would come before the directing any excess revenue. Sorry. So right after general election, semicolon. Line 5. Yep. Providing that the credit will be calculated by dividing the total revenue by the number of qualified electors, semicolon.
Yeah, I like that.
We're fine with that. But generally we'd also be fine with its omission because we don't think that the average voter who takes a look at this is going to have the knowledge to do the back of the napkin type math one way or the other anyway without going to the blue book. And what I mean by that is knowing how many people could have voted and how many people did vote. I don't think that will be common knowledge. So it's the idea that they are aware of those two things and they're then confused because they might use one versus the other. But that being said, we're fine with this.
I think most voters are aware that there's a turnout percentage.
I understand the objection. I think the board, at least two of the members, I think three, were of the opinion that we need to say something about this. I would say that qualified electors should be changed to eligible voters, just to map onto the language of the proposal. And sorry, Jason, I cut you off. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I've argued for sort of course, two subjects, and the statement you had was, well, so long as it's a tax, we can use the tax for multiple purposes. So why don't we just say what the purpose is and say, using the new revenue to fund a refundable income tax credit for any elector who votes in a Colorado election and to increase state general fund revenue.
I'm comfortable with the title clause.
We just say that's likely but not necessarily an accurate description.
The way that this particular credit is calculated gives rise to the excess. And so the excess, I think, is necessarily related to the topic of the tax increase and how the tax credit is calculated. I agree with you. This is a thorny subject, and I think your arguments are persuasive. I fall on the side of I think this is a single subject, and we set title for it.
Right. Well, we got to that point.
Right.
So now we're talking about notice.
No, and I understand that. And I think, well, in my view, the notice is there is a tax increase, and here's what it does. And I think we're giving notice by...
So you think that we're sufficiently saying what it does without referencing making more money available for general fund?
No, I think we need to make that in the title. Are you – it's just a question of where it falls within the title. Is it in the title clause or is it in the
– No, I'm saying it's in the trailer using the – starting line 4, using the new revenue to fund a refundable income tax credit for any elector who votes in a Colorado general election and to increase – general fund revenue.
Oh,
I see what you're saying. I don't have any objection to that.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I think the way it's written, I think, you know, if you have the calculation done based only on the dividing by the number of people who can claim the credit, then the intent is rather clearly to essentially give a credit, balance it out. And that any general fund overflow is essentially incidental. It's not really a purpose. It's an inevitable sort of consequence of some people who won't claim their credit, but that's on them. Writing it this way, it's a design feature that's integral to the initiative, that a bunch more money is almost certainly, you know, unless you manage to get 100% voter participation, is going to go into the general fund. So I think we need to say it, and I don't think it's... I know we're not supposed to look at the potential effects of things, but I think this is direct and integral to the initiative itself. You know, I don't think we have to really have a lot of outside knowledge or interpret effects grossly to say this is using a different base of people who claim the credit and a base on how you calculate the credit is sort of in and of itself sufficient to call getting more money to the general fund kind of necessary.
I understand.
It's an
inevitable
it's
a logical
effect.
Certainty.
If I could contribute to that discussion, what I think I'm hearing you saying is, in either scenario, there's going to be some excess money going to the general fund. It's most likely, and it's a different order of magnitude, in your opinion. And where it falls in that continuum is where you want to wait mentioning this to make sure the voters are informed. And I think it ends up being tertiary, regardless if it's for participating voters is the denominator or if it's eligible voters. And some of the information you're talking about that can feed into the assumption we have to make, even though we're not supposed to get into that, an automatic, a compulsory voting fine in Australia of the same magnitude took voter participation from 64% to 94%. So that gets a lot further on the end of the spectrum towards our opinion on this than where you're coming from. But regardless, we think that given the fact that any funds going into the general fund, any revenues going to the general fund, is a consequence of what is left unclaimed, to us means that they shouldn't be given equal weight or phrased the same way here. We like the current language where the voters are at least informed that we're not doing this necessarily to contribute to a tax credit and to the general fund. The general fund is a consequence. How big is that, you know, second order consequences up for debate? According to the estimate we have, it's zero, but it may be larger. Let me just go into the fiscal year spending estimate too. I point that out, that that's assuming all of it's claimed.
Well, I will say this, the fiscal note, you know, which is part of the process, acknowledges there will be an excess of $25 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not an excess, I don't think. I think that's the administrative costs.
It'll cost $25 million to administer a tax refund?
I also disagree with that assumption.
I don't know if that's part of their assumption, is it?
You can find on page 2.
Well, I think that it's actually 9 million. I mean, they're saying that 220 comes in 17-18 and 211 goes out in 18-19. Those are the numbers that go together. That's
yeah, so and part of their assumption in the final sentence is it is assumed that all eligible voters who cast a ballot will claim the credit, and that eligible voters who do not cast a ballot will not claim the credit. So I think the estimate of revenue impact includes the concern that the board has been expressing, which is that there will be excess general fund revenue.
I guess I'm struggling to find that they put an estimate of 0.5% to cover administrative costs, and I thought that tied with the $25 million number.
No, I see what's happened. What's difficult is because they have the chart in fiscal years, but they're using not 212 million. So they're estimating basically $1 million of administrative cost. They're saying that 211 million is going to come in for income tax year. 212 million are coming for income tax years 2017, and they're going to refund out 211 million, so all that minus 1 million. So that's what they're assuming. They're assuming that less administrative costs, everything that comes in will get paid out. It's just a little hard to follow because of the fiscal year versus income tax year difference. But regardless, I mean, to the point at hand, I think the question before us, right, is just whether we're giving notice of the likelihood that at least reasonably substantial amount of money is going to go to the general fund rather than being provided back to taxpayers in the form of this credit. And, you know, I sort of defer to you both on whether we think that's necessary or not. I believe it is, but you know.
Yeah, I think on a side note, I think we also have to change that dividing the total revenue by the number of eligible voters to be by the number of.
And I just want to say that. Oh, go ahead.
Registered electors, because if you're not registered, you're not going in the calculation. Eligible voters would be calculated by census, not by registration. So doesn't that need to say registered electors?
I just use the words from the proposal, right, which is divided by the eligible number of voters. And I suppose I read that to mean the number of eligible voters.
What did you all mean? Do you know what you meant?
Eligible to vote.
So you really are talking about census numbers? I mean, then you're talking about a much bigger number. Now you're getting into, I don't know how much of what you collect is going to go back out.
Well, yeah. Just to, for the record, I don't agree with the proponent's understanding of the fiscal note analysis. It seems to me, and I think this is what Jason was getting at, the credit is reduced 0.5%. I don't know where that $25 million comes from. That to me comes from the fact that not all who are eligible, there will be excess revenue. I think it's a bit confusing, but
no, what the $25 million is saying is it's because the impacts come in different years of the credit versus the tax rates. The $25 million is in 18-19, you're refunding the $211 million, which is based on the money collected in 17, the $212 million collected, less administrative costs. The $236 is the new money coming in, which is higher because
right.
Colorado income is increasing.
Right.
So that's where the total impact for 18-19 is $236 million coming in, less the $211 million based on what came in the prior years going out.
Right. And what
that's
this
where
is
you get the 25.
Right. And what this is assuming is that this tax increase will bring in a total over 2 years of $456 million. The tax credit will only be $211 million. I assume part of that because not all who...
Because the 18-19 income coming in is going out for the 2020 elections tax credit, not for the 18 right. tax credit. That's why. Because the tax is every year, the credit's every 2 years.
Right.
It just doesn't go out far enough to show all that money that's coming in 18-19 then going out later.
Right, and I understand all that. But, so if you go back to 16-17, 17-18, I don't know which way you want to slice it, but I don't think that – I think that the economists who did this note do acknowledge that there will be, as a matter of their analysis, excess revenue to the fund. That's all. That's the only point I want to make, and I think that informs the title. And I think it – underscores your argument for including and to increase general fund revenue. That's all I'm saying, is that the fiscal note supports your proposed change to the title.
And actually, oddly enough, I don't think that's right, not to undermine myself, because I think what you're not seeing is it's growing down the future. What this is showing, this is assuming, like I said, that the people, this is assuming that the eligible voters calculation, it doesn't say so, but it has to be, is intended to refund everything. And therefore, it does refund everything because you're using the same base. It assumes that eligible voters means people who actually voted. And then they say all of those people are going to claim it, and any other eligible elector who didn't vote won't claim it, and the amount on the credit is going to be based only on the people who voted. That's what this assumes. And that's why you're bringing in 212 and putting out 211, because all you're keeping is the administrative costs. Okay. So much as I wish it did support me, I don't think the fiscal note does. But
how do you, I don't want to get too down the weeds. That might be right. I still am struggling with what they meant by the last sentence in the fiscal note. But I think we should focus back on the language of the title.
Okay, I think we do have to go back to voters, even though that's an undefined term. So we might not be talking about 3 million. We might be talking about 4 million.
3.5, something like that.
Yeah, depends.
Eligible. If you live here and you're over 18 and you're not a felon.
Yeah, everybody who lives here is an eligible voter, because I don't know what voter means since it's not defined, but I don't think we're going to be going off the registration rolls.
What if we just used precisely what the
that
proposed
what
initiative?
Use.
Well,
don't they use eligible?
They use voters? Eligible number, not number of eligible. And I don't know what that means, but that is
I don't know
what
either.
It says. But what the proponents have clarified is that it will be a larger body than those who cast ballots.
Yeah.
So.
It'll be a larger body than those registered to
cast. We're reading eligible as pertaining to you can't be an eligible voter. We realize you have to have citizenship and be of age, but we think that eligible also means you're registered.
And that's, I think that's fine. I think it's captured by saying, by just using the language of the proposed initiative, which is the eligible number of voters.
Okay. Now, what were we thinking of including? Something else?
No, I think this is
it. I think the end to increase general fund revenue.
Oh, right. That which we did. Okay.
You know, to me, that gives, to me, the how the credit's calculated really is just a more opaque way of giving the same notice that I've said in to increase general fund revenue. So I don't even need that providing clause personally, but that's totally up to you guys.
I'm fine with it the way it is, right on the screen.
Yeah, I am too.
All right, let's accept it and I'll read it in. So it says state taxes shall be increased $220 million annually by imposing an additional tax of 0.5% on, I was going to say this before, on, can we take out the? Do we need the? On the Colorado taxable income?
Nope.
No. Okay. All right. By imposing an additional tax of 0.5% on Colorado taxable income that exceeds $405,000 of each individual estate or trust and in connection therewith, excluding the new revenue from the state fiscal spending limitation, using the new revenue to fund a refundable income tax credit for any elector who votes in a Colorado general election and to increase general fund revenue, providing that the credit will be calculated by dividing the total revenue by the eligible number of voters and directing any excess revenue to the general fund.
We worry that that last clause in line 7 is kind of confusing or vague.
I think it's
as far as what is the excess now, because we're putting the credit and an increase in general fund on equal footing. What will that be read to mean?
I think it'll, with my addition above the last clause, is unnecessary.
Okay. All right. Then we would end it by dividing the total revenue. Well, yeah.
We need an and after revenue on line 5.
I move that title.
Just quickly, can we just put another new in on line 6 after total? I would even say amount of new revenue. I know it's more words, but.
Okay. Fine with that. I'm going to read it again, just because we did some changes. State taxes shall be increased $220 million annually by imposing an additional tax of 0.5% on Colorado taxable income that exceeds $405,000 of each individual estate or trust, and in connection therewith, excluding the new revenue from the state fiscal spending limitation, using the new revenue to fund a refundable income tax credit for any elector who votes in a Colorado general election, and to increase general fund revenue, and providing that the credit will be calculated by dividing the total amount of new revenue by the eligible number of voters. Okay.
Could one last mention of this point? We think that it would add understanding of how this would operate to add the language on line 5, reading from the beginning of line 5, votes in a Colorado general election and any unclaimed revenues to increase general fund revenue. So that it's mentioned that the increase in general fund revenue is dependent on what's left unclaimed from the credit.
I don't have a problem with it conceptually. I'm trying to get the language right.
Perhaps to avoid being redundant, say, and any unclaimed funds to increase general fund revenue. I guess I can't get around it, but something to convey that.
I'm tempted to say something like using the new revenue primarily to fund a refundable income tax credit for any elector who votes. And I guess you can say, you know, and if
it's not,
I don't want to keep adding. Go ahead.
Primarily bothers me just because you could have a turnout less than 50% and then
okay,
you're not primarily doing that.
First.
Yeah, first to fund and then to, yeah, would be fun.
And then what, if any new revenue remains?
Unclaimed.
And for any?
Unclaimed revenue.
I like the word excess rather than unclaimed.
Excess revenue.
I would say and comma for any excess revenue comma to increase the general fund.
Yeah.
Then you take revenue out.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay. Anyone have anything else?
I have nothing more.
Want to move?
Sure. I move that we adopt the language of the title for proposed initiative 2015-60 number 58 concerning. Someone have a. Sorry. Concerning voter tax credit as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. All right. The do you guys want to take a break or you want to keep going?
We do have one administrative matter to take care of before we can hear the next one, which is the designated representative needs to execute the affidavit.
Okay.
So if we could take a short 10 to 15 minutes.
Oh, that's okay.
5 minutes.
All right.
Whatever. At the board's leisure. All right. All right.
Tonight?
We're ready to go back on the record whenever.
Bring him nephew home.
Halfway home. Is that him back there?
No.
With someone else.
Being brought up.
All right, we are back on the record, and the next item on the agenda is proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 46. And if the proponents could state their names and, yeah.
Mike Spaulding.
David Otke.
And can you tell us... why don't you give us a little history for the record and tell us how this tell us the single subject of this initiative and how this one differs from the previous initiatives.
Yeah, actually there is a lot of history, but the short bit is we've been getting closer thanks to help from the title board and the Supreme Court. But in the previous time we met, we looked at number 46, and objections were raised because we had, in the process of revamping it, added some texts that seemed to specify how to handle judicial enforcement. And we also had an ongoing problem with the vacancy specification in there. So we went ahead with this 46. We found a provision that allowed us, even though this is a rehearing, to actually change the initiative as long as we only eliminated text. So we eliminated everything that caused a single subject objection previously. And so now we have something that will help us avoid the confusion that's arisen over past recalls and increase the accountability of public officials to voters. So then as far as 54, we'll get to that later. But 46, I think now we'll find, if you look through the markup, which did they get copies of that?
The board has copies of the original amended and final text.
Okay. All right. So if you look at the markup, you see that we deleted the part where that specified some of the treating of the judicial part. So the judicial is just on retention, the accountability. And then the entire vacancy area, since it was such an unusual situation that would lead to that, with nobody ran to replace somebody who's being recalled, and since that did cause some problems with the single subject in the past, including at our last meeting, we've removed that entirely. So we'll just continue to handle that, you know, with the way it's currently handled.
So, Steve, I have a petition for the rehearing. Do you have one?
So the request for rehearing was filed by email.
Okay.
And we do have that in the record. I thought that I had included that in your packets.
I'm just making sure we have a request and everything we need.
Point of clarification, are we considering this a rehearing, or are we just considering it a new hearing that under Article 5.1, subsection 555, we can do because they're only making deletions?
Yeah, I think we have to consider this a new hearing, because if we set title today, we would be effectively on a rehearing. It wouldn't give any opponents an opportunity to come and be heard. So I think this is just a new hearing.
Because they haven't seen the new text, is that what you're saying? I mean, they've already issued their objections to the text, and that's why we have the rehearing.
Well, right, but they had no reason today to file for rehearing, and rehearing is a requirement to then appeal. So they had no reason to file for rehearing because there was no title set. And so this would be effectively denying them an ability to then appeal the title because
right.
They're not here today for
that's
the
right.
Rehearing.
We're the ones who filed for the rehearing. So.
Right, okay. Yeah. So this is actually not a rehearing, just to be procedurally clear about what we're doing. We're
important.
Having another hearing.
Okay.
And then if we set title today, there could still potentially be a rehearing.
And is that consistent with Section 5155, that it resets it to a hearing from a rehearing?
Yes, I think that's right. And perhaps I'll put this in for the benefit of anyone listening in. What it says, and this is reading only the relevant parts of Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution. If a measure contains more than one subject such that a ballot title cannot be fixed that clearly expresses a single subject, which was our last situation, no title shall be set and the measure shall not be submitted to the people for adoption or rejection at the polls. In such circumstance, however, the measure may be revised and resubmitted for the fixing of a proper title without the necessity of review and comment on the revised measure in accordance with subsection 5 of this section, unless the revisions involve more than the elimination of provisions to achieve a single subject. And then it goes on a bit. But here we have a situation where all you've done is eliminated provisions to achieve a single subject. So we're just going straight to a new hearing.
So we're just avoiding the legislative council's input?
Correct.
Okay.
And I'll state for the record that the designated representatives did include that language from the Constitution in their filing.
Okay. All right. Then.
Also, one more thing for the record. We can decide not to proceed if we believe the revisions are so substantial that such review and comment by the legislative council is in the public interest. I don't believe that to be the case here. But I wanted to make that clear for the record in case questions arose later.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case either. Okay. All right, then we're back to the discussion on the single subject.
All right. I guess I can start on this. And as the proponents and the board well remember, I think we've not set titles and we've had somewhat slightly different opinions on this, where I feel that the other members of the board feel that the issue is most likely the inclusion of judges and retention in addition to other public officers and recall in the same initiative. So I'm not sure that the changes made today will convince them of that, that we have a single subject now. That said, I've taking a slightly broader view, while I feel that there's a good chance that their position is the right one, I think there's also a pretty good chance that a court will agree with them. I do think that public accountability of officers, depending on what's under it, is not necessarily too broad to be a single subject. The things that I was most concerned about last time, the proponents have removed from the initiative, so I will, with not a great deal of confidence, vote to find that this proposed initiative has a single subject.
You want me to?
Yeah, why don't you?
I am sympathetic to that description and understanding. I, unfortunately, am of the view, though it's not crystal clear, that the court would believe that retention and recall are two different subjects and can't be included in a single proposed initiative. So I would vote to deny title setting.
I mean, even though there's a part of me that would love to see what they think, I'm fairly confident that the courts are not going to, based on their prior decisions, believe that the retention of judicial officers is related to recall. They are different types of elections. They are different, different election laws that relate to those, and I just don't see them saying that judicial retention and recall of a public officer are related. So I think the problem is that at one point there was, I mean, anyway, I don't think it's going to happen. And so I am similarly inclined to continue to say that with the inclusion of the judicial officers, that this is not a single subject.
Okay, but before we vote, the Supreme Court, when they responded, they picked out specific judicial things. They talked about home rule judges in Denver. They talked about other things. They didn't address judges in general. They addressed specific instances that they had problems with. And, you know, in the past we looked at this and we just decided that looking at the retention of judges that were elected, such as those in Inglewood, was a problem. But the retention of judges in general is just part of the accountability of judges. That's the way judges are accountable. And recall is the way public, you know, or other officers are accountable. They're all part of our government. And this is public accountability, public officer accountability to voters. And when a voter goes into the poll, he's doing accountability. And, you know, some check marks are on the judicial side and some check marks are for other officers. But it's the same thing. It's accountability to voters. So if we can look at the broader thing, as Jason has suggested, then we can see it all as public accountability of public officers to the voters.
Well, except that in the case of these home rule judges, their accountability is to an elected body, which is different than at the state level. At the state level, they are subject to retention votes and they can be removed by the voters, but there's two categories that you could be removed. At a local level, you could be removed at any point by a vote of your city council, if that's who appoints you. There is that accountability there. And so you're creating a new type of an election for a different category of people who were not previously subject to that process, which is the same problem they had with the original, which again, I voted for a single subject, you know, back when you put forth your original title a couple years ago. And the Supreme Court's issue at that point was the inclusion of government officials, essentially. So, for instance, you know, I think they even called out, you know, the deputy or the secretary of state or the solicitor general or someone like that could be recalled, where previously there was no direct accountability to the voters. And that's the same kind of category you have with some of these judges. They currently have no direct accountability to voters. There is no, they sit for no election. We are indirectly accountable to people who are voted in, but we don't stand for a vote. And I just don't see how this is different by bringing in all of these judges who have not previously been positions that stand for votes and bringing them in. I just don't see it a whole lot different than what they said I couldn't do 2 years ago.
Of course, now we don't include judges that are elected. So they're already being retained. Retention's already there. We're just changing the terms of retention.
But you're adding other judges to that retention, right?
It
all
says
non-elected
all
judicial,
non-elected.
Right. Well, most judicial officers at a municipal level are appointed by a city council.
And they aren't subject to retention elections currently?
They can just be removed at any time, just like their other employees. They can be removed. So that's really more similar than the category that we had 2 years ago. Because again, you have people who serve at the pleasure of somebody else. So just like I serve at the pleasure of the secretary, but I don't stand for an election, but he does. This is almost the exact same kind of thing you have here, because now you have all non-elected judicial officers. So you kind of fix that little Inglewood niche where, right, you know, you have judges who do get elected. but now we have almost every other non-elected judge who's been appointed by somebody.
So if it was non-elected and non-appointed, then you wouldn't be changing the way the judges are held accountable, and so you wouldn't call that a second subject.
Right. And I don't recall. Do you define judicial officer somewhere?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, are you talking about magistrates too and administrative law judges? And I mean, who do we have in here?
Officer means any state or local active or senior justice or judge. So I guess that wouldn't include magistrates.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't know either.
But
you were fine with your position to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, my view, perhaps this is too broad a understanding of the Supreme Court, is that there's recall and there's retention. Those are two separate things, and putting them under one umbrella might be problematic. Certainly, in the very least, the concerns that Suzanne articulated, I share. I guess what I'm saying is it would be very likely to be acceptable if this was a recall provision only and did not include provisions governing retention. But as it is currently written now, I don't think that the Supreme Court would uphold its title setting.
Yeah, I don't either. Do you want to make a motion?
I move to find we lack jurisdiction to set title.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Opposed? All right. Okay, so we're going to move to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 54. All right, if the proponents could state their names for the record.
Mike Spaulding.
David Otke. Okay.
You want to tell us the differences in here?
They are minor. Excess text is eliminated in a couple places. There are two items of enforcement. So enforcement adds no reporting of donations to committees that are against retention. It also takes a 60-day provision and reduces it to 30 days. And that, you know, in the enforcement thing, time for Supreme Court. So those are the only two major changes. Unfortunately, it probably doesn't address the issues we just brought up.
I mean, I don't think it fixes what I have, which, for the record, I'll incorporate our arguments in number 46 that we heard right before this one.
Before we even get to that, and I'm afraid this is a little bit hyper-technical, but I think we do not have jurisdiction to set a title on this for another reason.
Okay.
Which is, in this one, the same changes to the text were made. I'm taking out those things that I had mentioned and others had mentioned, find objectionable on 46 about the official retention reports and the extended vacancies. The difference is here, those provisions, this just came straight to us from Legislative Council in the review and comment hearing, and those provisions were not addressed in that review and comment hearing or looking back in any of the other review and comment hearings.
Right.
And therefore, their removal of them was not in direct response to questions raised at the review and comment hearing, and it's a slightly different provision. It's section 140-105, subsection 2 of the statutes. And what it says, sorry, I should have had it open. After the public meeting, but before submission to the Secretary of State for title setting, the proponents may amend the petition in response to some or all of the comments of the directors of the Legislative Council and the Office of Legislative Legal Services or their designees. If any substantial amendment is made to the petition, other than amendment in direct response to the comments of the directors of the Legislative Council and the Office of Legislative Legal Services, the amended petition shall be resubmitted to the directors for comment in accordance with subsection 1 of this section prior to submittal to the Secretary of State, as provided in subsection 4 of this section.
Now, you know, it feels like a catch-22 because, of course, you made those changes in response to what you knew was coming from here on 46. But that said, that's still what the statute says. So I think we lack jurisdiction for that reason.
Okay. I think that's right. I will incorporate my comments, whether or not I have jurisdiction to argue them, from 46, just to make clear that these are very similar and that any arguments that would have been raised in response to a title setting determination, whether we have jurisdiction, I would have raised. So on whatever basis we determine we lack jurisdiction, I agree we lack it.
Well, someone needs to frame the motion, so...
I think it's more procedurally correct to frame the motion under the statute as opposed to finding that we lack title, because technically this same proposal could be submitted for review and comment and could come back to us in exactly this form.
Right.
So I don't think we can rule on jurisdiction under single subject right now. I think we have to rule on jurisdiction as the procedural defect.
Why don't you make the motion then, Jason?
Okay. I move that the title board finds that it lacks jurisdiction to set title for proposed initiative 2015-60 number 54, public accountability officers, on the grounds that the proponents have made substantial responses to the initiative following the review and comment hearing that were not made in direct response to the comments of the directors of the Legislative Council and the Office of Legislative Legal Services, which is... which doing so requires resubmittal for review and comment under section 140.105, subsection 2 CRS.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Then we find we lack jurisdiction to proceed on that matter, and that concludes the agenda for today. And the time is 2:50.
Significantly before 5 o'clock.